Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, can the Republican Party actually attract African Americans to their party with Donald Trump leading their ticket? We'll talk with an African American recently hired by the party to help make that happen. Also, an endorsement out of North Carolina. A black church there, the whole church has endorsed Donald Trump for president. Well, we'll talk to the pastor as well as his daughter as to exactly why they made that decision. Also, will transgender students be allowed at Spelman College? They are discussing that very issue. We'll discuss that with two transgender advocates right here on News One Now. Also, Olympic fever as the world watches the 2016 Rio Games. We'll look back at the 1936 Olympics, not just when it comes to Jesse Owens, but the other African-American athletes who performed there in the film Olympic Pride, American Prejudice. We'll talk with the writer and director of the film. News One Now starts right now. Black women voted at a higher rate in 2008 and 2012 than any other group in the country. But guess which party they hate the most? Republicans. That is, Republicans do worse when it comes to black women than anybody else. We now see it 83 days away from the presidential election, the general election. And Donald Trump is not polling well when it comes to African Americans. Recent polling data out of Ohio and Pennsylvania shows he's polling at 0%. Plus minus margin is somewhere around 3%. So it could be as high as 3% or it could be negative 3%. Right now, let's talk with Ashley Bell. He was recently hired by the Republican National Committee as their director of African-American political engagement. He joins us right now. So, Ashley, first and foremost, you've got a candidate not liked by black folks, not liked by Arab Americans, not liked by college-educated white voters. You got a problem.
I got a job to do. I got a job to do. You know, it's not just my job, it's the job of the whole party. You know, we have work to do, but I'm glad this chairman, Rents Priebus, is willing to do it and invest the resources to keep trying to increase our stance with black Americans. This, you could easily, look at those poll numbers, some candidates, some parties would say, you know what, let's give it up, let's focus other places. We're doubling down.
But yeah, but here's the issue, though. And I have talked to a number of black Republicans who support Donald Trump, and I've asked them, where's Donald Trump's job plan? Haven't seen it. Where's Donald? She talks about black unemployment. I've never seen him actually talk about it, address it in detail. Where's his HBCU plan? Haven't seen it. Where's his plan when it comes to empowerment zones? Haven't seen it. Where's his plan even when it comes to education, issue of school choice, which is high among the list of African Americans? Haven't seen it. So how do you think you're going to get black votes when you have a candidate who refuses to go into detail about policy matters, who gives a speech the other day in Detroit and doesn't even address what happened economically in Detroit?
You know, the one thing about the Republican Party is that we understand that the president can't govern alone. There are leaders in the Congress who touch on all those issues. If he gets elected, we hope he works with Republicans.
But he's
Congress.
At the top of your ticket. And so if you have a candidate who doesn't even address those issues, how do you think you're going to get black votes?
Look, he gave a speech on economic policy just a couple days ago. He did not touch on very race-specific solutions. That's true.
No. I didn't say race-specific.
Okay.
The reality is this here. If you focus on where the need is the most, African-American Latinos will be at that top. Wasn't even discussed, wasn't even mentioned.
Well, we have to do a better job of telling our narrative, because I think it was. When Donald Trump says things like, you know, I'm going to decrease capital gains, the job of the Republican Party, myself and everyone else included, is to explain to black voters what that means. That means if you're a brother and you live in a neighborhood and you're trying to flip a house, and you're trying to flip that house so you can make, it's a dilapidated house, you're trying to fix it up and make money, the money you make off that house is a capital gain. We just have to tell the story in a narrative so people understand
but
it.
But Ashley,
not necessarily that it's not there.
When you talk about decreasing capital gains, you're benefiting folks who are on Wall Street. You're not benefiting that brother who's on MLK Street.
You are. If he's going to make, if you're flipping a house because you are maybe an ex-felon or someone who can't get a normal job, and you all of a sudden have a windfall of cash, that matters. Republicans believe you can take that money, and we're not worried about you, you know, save it, not just save it and not spending it. You want to keep that money because you want to buy another house in your neighborhood to flip that house and do it again.
You recently had the voter suppression ruling in North Carolina.
Right.
I haven't heard Donald Trump talk about that. I've heard him talk about touting voter ID when, in fact, the reason it was passed in North Carolina, the reason it was passed in Pennsylvania was about so-called voter fraud, even though there's absolutely no evidence of that. And also, the Washington Post recently had a story talking about nearly 1 billion votes have been cast, an exhaustive analysis, 31 examples of voter fraud out of a billion votes being cast. And so if you're a black voter in North Carolina, has Trump talked about that? Has he talked about that particular bill which was thrown, which was where the court said it was a targeted effort to suppress black voters?
You know, it's interesting. Donald Trump has talked about he's afraid of a rigged election. Now, he needs to get more specific on that.
Yeah, what does that mean?
If he's afraid of a rigged election,
aren't black folks afraid of a rigged election?
I think
when you have a bill like in North Carolina, where the court said it was a laser-like focus specific on black folks.
No, I agree. I think
a Republican governor who signed it.
Mutual interests here agree that this could be a rigged election. Everyone needs to make sure the voter.
No, stop. Okay. You keep saying this could be a rigged election.
Right.
How?
Well, you just brought it up. You said voter fraud.
31 examples of voter fraud out of 1 billion votes cast. 1 billion. How is that a large example of voter fraud?
Well, look, just because every election, we all need to be concerned to make sure the right people are voting. Every election.
I got you.
Every election.
But 31 billion.
You never take a cycle off.
31 out of a billion? 31 of a billion.
I'm not sure.
That's 31.
Right.
And 1-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0.
Rolling. So you would like to say there's never going to be voter fraud in this country?
No, what I'm saying is this here. When you have Republicans in North Carolina who specifically pass a bill saying, oh, this is to protect voter fraud, that's non-existent. When in Pennsylvania, they did the exact same thing, and when the leading Republican in Pennsylvania said in 2012, this voter bill would get Mitt Romney elected, when in fact, when they went to court, the attorney general filed a document with the state that said we have no evidence of voter fraud. None. So they passed a bill based on a lie. What I'm saying is, where's Donald Trump on this issue?
You know, we would all like to hear Donald Trump expound a lot more details about a lot more issues. This is one that I agree that some voters would be interested in hearing about, and he should, as he develops his policy, talking about what he means for a rigged election. I agree with you. It should be thought about a little bit more.
Here's a New York Times story. Shelley, pull up my iPad, please. GOP urges Donald Trump to broaden outreach to black voters. In this story, they talk about what he did and did not do, did not go to the National Association of Black Journalists, didn't go to NAACP, didn't go to National Urban League. I haven't seen Donald Trump do one interview with any black media outlet. I haven't heard him. He talks about black folks to Bill O'Reilly, which I'm sorry, last I checked, is not really the place maybe you want to go to discuss black voters. How can you even remotely think you're going to get black voters when you have a candidate who won't even talk to black voters, who has not done, according to this story, who has not done a single event targeting black voters?
That's about to change. And I can say that I'm proud to say that one of the first things we did coming into the RNC is to try to find ways of working with our coalition team in the field to make sure that can change. That is a stark reality that I understand, and I think many black Republicans understand, and that is the first step going forward in how we lay out the next 90 days, is making sure we show up on black campuses, make sure we have black events. That is what engagement is. That's part of the process.
This is a quote from Tara Wall, a longtime Republican National Committee operative. Quote, he's alienated a number of minority voters, and that's reflected in his low numbers. You have to do the bare minimum, and he's not even doing that. So when you say it's going to happen, like what? What is he going to do?
Well, it's going to start with us working. Look, we have 12 battleground states that have coalitions directors. The Trump campaign has hired coalition directors in all 12 states. My job, support Omarosa, support black engagement. All the battleground states.
Okay, those are?
You want to list them. Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, Iowa, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Virginia. How many we at now?
So we can blow blow New Hampshire off. Ain't many black folks there. But again though, what? So you're telling me that Donald Trump and the Republican National Committee is going to be active in black communities in those states. So doing exactly what?
Well, it begins like right now. We're rolling out a plan to engage younger millennials on college campuses. You will see our collective effort to be on college campuses, to talk about the issues that face historically black college. You're going to see us working with...
Does Donald Trump have an HBCU plan? Because I've yet to see it.
Well, part of the first 90 days, the last 90 days, is working with our coordinated campaign and coming up with a plan to engage black voters.
I don't mean engage. I'm saying, does Donald Trump have a specified plan to deal with HBCUs?
Well, you know the answer to that. He doesn't.
Okay. So not only that, Donald Trump doesn't even have a specified plan when it comes to even school choice. I was at the National Charter School Conference where the folks there reached out to his campaign, and the answer that came back was, we'll get to that after the election.
Look, nobody is trying to make excuses for the lack of specific policies that relate to African Americans. Nobody is.
So if he doesn't have a specific plan, how do you even remotely going to get black voters? Because he has no plan.
Because we're campaigning as the Republican Party. We're campaigning as the party of opportunity, the party with big ideas, good ideas for black America. And what we have to do is make sure our message reaches everybody.
But Ashley, he's leading your ticket.
Right.
If the person leading your ticket has no plan, has no plan of action, has no agenda, has no specifics, you're not going to get black votes.
Roland, our job is to continue to compete. We're not going to concede this election to Democrats. And a lot of folks like us to pack up and go home. We're not. We're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep talking about the policies that the Republican Party has been for and remain for before and after this election. It doesn't end November 9th. The fight to make sure that this country has two options, that black America has two parties that are fighting for their vote, doesn't stop November 8th. Everything we're doing now is trying to institutionalize in the Republican Party.
Okay, but
the fight continues.
But here's the issue for me. How can the Republican Party say they're fighting for the votes of black folks when the party is making a concerted effort to suppress black votes?
No, I don't think the party's making a concerted effort.
Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Virginia, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Texas, Ohio. Those are all places where Republicans have done that. North Carolina, Republican legislature, Republican governor. Texas, Republican legislature, Republican governor. Ohio, Republican governor. I mean, I can go on and on. From the moment the Supreme Court...
That all Republicans try to suppress black vote.
Here's what I can say. The fact of the matter is here, in Ohio, they try to suppress the vote. They got more than 300,000 signatures to put it on the ballot. Guess what?
To
repeal the voter suppression law in Ohio. What did the legislature do? They pulled it because they knew they were going to get voted down in November 2012. No. That's Ohio. Pennsylvania passed the voter ID law, voter suppression, with no evidence of voter fraud. North Carolina, one of the most egregious examples. We see what happened in Florida with Governor Rick Scott, Republican. They sit white folks off the polls and off the election rolls, and many of them were eligible to actually vote as well. We can see example after example. And so what I'm saying is here. How can Republicans talk about competing for black votes when the party in different states, the evidence is there, has tried to suppress the vote? In Texas, they just threw out the voter ID law in Texas.
Look, in a larger sense, I would hope we can agree that we want to see every American vote.
Yes.
We want every black person to vote. The RNC specifically, the Republican National Committee is under a consent decree that we can't get involved in any voter challenging or anything. That's been in place for 30 years.
But we haven't touched it. But when you have retired General Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, who went to North Carolina, stood in front of Governor Pat McCrory and said point blank, this law is wrong. This law should not pass. That was a Republican, Colin Powell, saying, you're not going to get black votes if you keep doing this crap.
Look, Roland, I agree. You're always going to find instances of Republicans doing things that black folks can look at and say, I don't like that. But they don't speak for my party. They don't speak for the entire party. You're always going to have those instances. And every black Republican at some point has to check those folks every time they pop up. But our role, Republican National Committee, is to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to vote for Republican if they want to. And how do we do that? We put the message on the ballot. The message and the principles are bigger than any candidate, and we'll be here after the election.
I can tell you this right now. You're not going to get black votes if the party systematically is about voter suppression. And here's the other piece here. You got Bob Goodlatte of the House Chair, House Judiciary Committee, who refuses to move on the Sensenbrenner bill, a Republican out of Wisconsin, when it comes to the Voting Rights Act. When you have Senator Tom Cotton, Republican out of Arkansas, who's holding a criminal justice reform bill in the United States Senate.
But there's so many Republicans that are trying to push it. Don't get me wrong.
No, wait. Hold on. No.
But you point out the few that are against it.
Not the few are against it. Goodlatte from Virginia is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He will not allow that committee to even have a vote on the Sensenbrenner bill of the VRA. In fact, there are fewer Republican sponsors of the Sensenbrenner bill this year than there were in the last U.S. Congress. Those are Republicans. And what I'm saying is this here.
It's a Republican bill. Republicans have their own.
But here's the deal.
Republicans are supporting. There's bipartisan support.
Well, why won't Goodlatte? Okay, will the RNC tell Congressman Goodlatte allow the committee to vote on this?
Roland, you know very well. Before I took this job, I was chair of 2020, had one job. Focus on criminal justice reform.
Okay.
I've been advocating for my party to push this forward consistently and relentlessly.
So will you call out Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Republican, and tell him stop blocking the bipartisan criminal justice reform bill in the U.S. Senate?
I've been having that conversation before I started this job, and I'll continue to have it.
Okay, but here's the deal, though, and that's what I'm saying. When you have people like Cotton who are blocking the bill, when you have people like Congressman Goodlatte who are blocking the bill, black folks are going, show me the proof. You down with African Americans?
I'm proud of Senator Cornyn, all of the senators that are behind it, who've been pushing it this far, and I know there's some that are standing in the way.
No. They're blocking it. Not standing in the way. They're blocking it, Ashley, and that's the problem.
It is the same thing. I agree with you, but I'm proud of the fact that it wouldn't be on the table if Republicans hadn't led. This is a bipartisan issue. I'm not going to let it become a partisan issue because the Republican Party has ran all other Republicans. The criminal justice reform bill
is a bipartisan bill. But it is a Republican, Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas, who is blocking that bill from moving forward. They announced it several months ago, and it's gone nowhere. It is Congressman Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, who is blocking Sensenbrenner's bill from moving forward, who's also Republican. And what I'm saying is, if the Republican Party wants to reach out to African Americans, they better do a much better damn job of stop blocking efforts and then saying, no, we're going to support it. Because I'll say this here. Look, if that Sensenbrenner bill is allowed to vote on the floor, I guarantee you it'll pass with Republican and Democratic votes. Yeah. But Goodlatte is blocking it from moving forward.
100% agree.
100%. Well, I want to see some action. I'd love to see Chairman Rice Priebus tell Bob Goodlatte, hey, stop blocking the bill. Let it go forward with the vote. Will that happen?
That's not our job. We don't do policy. We do policy.
Actually, you do policy because you do speak on policy from the party.
We do speak on the policy and the platform the Republican Party passes.
I say,
but personally, I agree with you 100%.
Let's speak on. We'll have to speak on that policy.
100%.
All right, Ashley. Appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
All right, brother. Good to see you.
We come back. We're going to talk with pastor and his daughter of a black church in Charlotte, North Carolina, that's endorsing Donald Trump. All of that next. News One Now, TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Well, so black church in Charlotte, North Carolina held a rally a couple of weeks ago where church members all endorse Donald Trump. Now, it's against the rules for a church to endorse, but there are members of the church who actually endorse. The church is Antioch Road to Glory International Ministries, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. And so, again, they had that huge rally there. There were a number of folks who were there from the Trump campaign, including Laura Trump. You see the photo we have here. This was her speaking at that particular event as well. And so joining us right now to talk about that, actually Laura is Trump's daughter-in-law. Quote, the church is led by Pastor Thomas Rogers, and most of all of his congregation is said to be behind the church's decision. Here's some of the video from there.
It's not about upsetting anyone. It's not about choosing sides. It's about change. The church right now, we have full support. No one has been asked to vote or swing one way or the other.
The world needs to change. America needs change. And I think because they're not right wing or not left wing, you're not liberal. And he's a business-minded person. And I think the Democratic Party would be a major disaster right now.
Well, you see African Americans actually waking up and making decisions is different. For 52 years, this church feels like the Democratic Party has failed them.
All right, folks, joining us right now, the church's executive secretary and the pastor's daughter, Katrina Rogers. She supports her father's decision. We also have Pastor Rogers here. Welcome to News One Now.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Question for both of you. First of all, have either one of you actually met with Donald Trump?
We have not met with Mr. Donald Trump personally at this time, but we have been engaged through his North Carolina State Director, Mr. Earl Phillips.
I listened to that video there, Apostle Thomas Rogers. You said that you're supporting him for change. Like what? What specifically?
Well, it's very specifically in the book of Exodus, Numbers, chapter 15, verse 24 through verse 29. There's an ignorant spirit among our people. And as God sent Moses to help him go to the promised land, there was some resentment. Mr. Martin, we have the largest penal system in the world. We have the largest homeless population in the world. We had more gangbangers in Chicago, California. So what my aims and objections is to seek dual citizenship from the United Nations.
I'm sorry. I got a question for you. You talked about our prison population. I have not heard a single speech from Donald Trump that was specific to how we deal with mass incarceration in the United States. So if that's one of the reasons why you're supporting him, he's never even spoken on it. Why would you back him if he's never even addressed it?
My aims and objective is that when the United States was set up by America, it was the people that govern, and the president, he is a leader. I think that we African Americans need a vision. The Bible says in Proverbs 28:19, where there's no vision, the people perish.
I understand that, sir, but when you say there's no vision, the people perish, but Donald Trump has not offered a vision for the people to even pay attention to. Literally, like I said, Katrina, maybe you can answer the question for me. I have not heard Donald Trump give a single speech on mass incarceration in this country. You have 10% of all HBCUs right there in North Carolina. I have not heard an HBCU plan from Donald Trump dealing with North Carolina. As I just said to Ashley Bell, voter suppression, you have one of the worst voter suppression laws in North Carolina right there. I have not heard Donald Trump condemn that. So I'm trying to understand what is the rationale, what the reasoning for you and your church endorsing Donald Trump when he has not spoken on any of these issues.
Mr. Rowland, in all due respect, quite frankly, you're quite factual in some of that.
I'm factual in some of it or all of it? Because I'm factual in all of it.
As far as saying all of it. What we're doing, we're repositioning ourselves. And instead of letting the politician come to us with the policy, we actually went to the politician this time with the policy.
But here's the problem, Katrina. You just said you haven't even met with Donald Trump. So
exactly. But I've been working through the protocols of his chain commanders that were speaking with his officials, Earl Phillips, and those of the Trump campaign that's here in North Carolina. They've been our vehicle as far as trying to get this information in front of him. And so we can move forward on making sure the same thing that most Democrats have done. I mean, it's been in their hands for a long time. Our voice and people, we dealing with these issues under a Democratic majority now. So, politicians to come to us to.
But Katrina, let me correct you. First of all, in your state, you have a Republican governor, a Republican legislature.
Certainly.
Okay, right now in Congress.
I'm talking about overall.
Katrina, you're wrong. Right now, Republicans control 31 of the 50 governor's mansions in the country. Right now, Republicans control a majority of the state legislatures. Right now, the Republicans control the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. So when you say we have a Democrats are running the country, that is factually incorrect.
Well, Democrats have been in the majority since 1964 moving forward.
Where?
Everywhere throughout America.
That is simply not true. 1964, Democratic president. 1968, Republican was elected. 1972, Republican was elected. 1976, Democrat was elected. 1980, Republican. 1984, Republican. 1988, Republican. 1992 and 96, Democrat. 2000 and 2004 were Republicans. 2008 and 12, Democrats. What you're saying is factually incorrect, but I'm still trying to understand. Again, if you say you want change, and you mention criminal justice, and you mention other issues, I'm just trying to understand, what did you put before the Trump campaign that caused your church to say, we want to endorse Donald Trump en masse, Apostle Rogers?
Yes, sir, thank you. As I stated earlier, the Bible says, well, there's no vision, the people perish. We politicians, we mean well. But there are some people out here that have a better plan for God's people. We have in our portfolio today to take a great plan to Mr. Trump.
What's the plan? What's in your plan?
Dual citizenship. The right to return here, brother, New Africa, 4,000 miles of highways, all of which from the Indian Ocean into the Atlantic Ocean, creating jobs for young people.
One second, Pastor Rogers. You just said building a highway from across the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian. You said
Indian Ocean. Uh-huh.
You said building a highway from the United States to Africa.
No, I know better than that. You both.
No. I'm trying to. You said across the Indian Ocean.
No, from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, a place where we came from. And in the United Nations Charter, there's a thing called place to return. So we African Americans, after next year, whoever gets in, we said we'll have homeless people and unemployed people, gangbangers, prison population. So it's up to us to bring forth leadership from the Gulf.
So you believe that Donald Trump is going to endorse this?
I hope he will. I believe he will.
So this was the basis of your endorsement of Donald Trump?
Business minded. Yes, business minded. When Moses went down to Egypt, he did not argue with Pharaoh. He spoke five words. Pharaoh, let my people go. We will not benefit under no party. We need a home.
But I got to ask you this question. Donald Trump ran a casino company that lost $1 billion worth of value in a decade while he made $39 million. He's filed for bankruptcy on four different occasions. He has stiffed a number of small business owners when it comes to paying them for their services. And so when you say he's been a successful businessman, that's the kind of person you want running the country, Katrina? Somebody who is stiff small business owners, who ran a casino company into the ground, who filed for bankruptcy on four different occasions?
Listen, Mr. Martin, in all due respect, we are not here as a radical political group. We are not here trying to change anybody's mind. We took a stand on to what our position were, especially coming from the Christian world. We would like to see changes made. We are actively involved in that dialogue. And so we're putting a challenge out there to everybody, both Republican and Democrat, to use this time to use their voice as a currency and to wager our voice to each of the candidates to make sure that our cause be heard, both on the Democratic side and the Republican side.
Okay. All right. Apostle Rogers, Katrina Rogers, we appreciate you joining us right here on TV One News One Now. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's go to our panel here, Douglas Sloan, principal and senior analyst with the National Capital Group, Amber Phillips, co-director of Black, Eugene Craig III, vice chair of the Maryland Republican Party.
Appreciate being on. I don't know where to start here. First and foremost, these guys broke rule number one of endorsing somebody. You first meet with the person. You size them up. You make sure they're worth your endorsement. Secondly, one, they don't got a plan, and Team Trump don't got a plan. I'm going to say this. I'm a Republican. I'm a young Black Republican. I'm a vice chair of a state party. I have not endorsed Donald Trump for a reason. Particularly, he has no plan on criminal justice reform. Just like my brother Ashley, I'm a member of a group called 2020 that, sole focus is criminal justice reform. And, that's my number one issue this cycle. And, I cannot get behind a presidential candidate that does not have a plan. Thirdly, this is America, the greatest country in the world. For a candidate that's vehemently anti-immigrant, I'm 99.999% sure he's not going to support dual citizenship with somewhere else.
I didn't understand where they were coming from, and what kept popping into my mind was, these people sound like Sarah Palin. I just couldn't get a handle on what he was saying or where he was coming from. And he was talking about a bridge over the Indian Ocean. Right. Does he realize the Indian Ocean harbors the deepest trench in the world, the Marianas Trench in the Indian Ocean, that goes 7 miles down? They can't even build a bridge from Puerto Rico to the Virgin Islands because of the depth of the ocean. I didn't understand what he was talking about.
I think this is also highlighting the fact that, one, black people are not a monolith. And that's also how Trump is approaching the campaign and how sometimes all folks who are running for national politics approach this work. But I think the more I would like to throw it back in, because I feel bad for them, that sometimes not all of our beliefs are steeped in facts. But then additionally, putting this back to the grander issue that, you know, as a Republican, as a young black Republican, what are you all doing to push this man to either A, be more inclusive, to represent you better? Because I hear a lot of folks trying to distance themselves from Donald Trump, but at the end of the day, not making a decision against him.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll answer that. First and foremost, Donald Trump has recently brought on an A-team. I think there's a couple things that matter when it comes to presidential campaigns. First, you need somebody there that has direct access to the candidate, and that's Omarosa. Secondly, the RNC has brought on an A-team, and Elroy Saylor, Ashley Bell, and Shannon Reeves.
With 90 days left.
Whose focus is to work up and down the ballot, to help folk like a Kathy Schlegel in Maryland or Elaine McAllister out of Pennsylvania? So, you know, Donald Trump, you know, he's going to be Donald Trump. And I know, quite frankly, I don't, you know, we'll see what happens.
Let me say this here. I am not opposed to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. I don't subscribe to any party. What I do want are answers. Mm-hmm. And the problem I have is you're not getting answers from this Trump campaign. Mm-hmm. You're not getting any policy specifics. Mm-hmm. I have asked, we were at the Republican National Convention, interviewed numerous people. And I even had one woman who was a delegate from Long Island who said, I'm sorry, I'm not hearing any specifics. The issue that I have is when you cannot offer a vision for the country, that's a problem. This is about the presidency. This is not about bringing anybody on and embarrassing. Look, Ashley's a great guy. I've known Ashley over the last several years. But he understands that when the party's not doing their job, they make it difficult. I've talked to many longtime black Republicans who are frustrated with what the party's lack of speaking to critical issues that relate to African Americans. But the point here is, if you can't answer those basic questions, then that's a problem when it comes to the presidency.
Absolutely.
I don't understand how he made it through the vetting process of the Republican primary without offering any specifics. He just gives outcomes and no policies.
70% of Republicans voted for somebody not named Donald Trump.
Bottom line is, 17 people ran, you didn't need to get 50%.
He had 24%.
I understand that.
And that's how he won.
He played the rules.
There you go. So bottom line is,
whose fault is this?
If 17 people ran and one person picked up a third of the vote, they could win. The bottom line is, in the primary, voters voted for Trump. That's what they wanted. That's what they got. Now you got to live with it. I got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a settlement out of New York in the Kai Gurley case, numbering several million dollars. Also, will transgender students be allowed to enroll at Spelman College, the nation's preeminent college for black women? Right here next on News 1 Now TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Well, only a few of the nation's 39 all-female colleges have opened their doors to transgender students since the first one did in 2014. Now the issue of inclusion has reached the doorsteps of Spelman College, of course, located in Atlanta. In a statement, they announced they're going to be launching a task force to study the issue. This was a statement from Mary Schmidt Campbell, president of Spelman College. In keeping with our intention to be a leader in Title IX practices, Spelman is convening a task force that will make recommendations to the president on the admission and enrollment of transgender students. We anticipate a report by the end of the academic year. This has led to lots of conversation in various circles. I was talking with some Spelman graduates, and they said it's been contentious and heated when it comes to graduates as to whether or not transgender students should be allowed at all-female Spelman College. Joining us right now, trans activist London Smith Derishlu. Is it correct? Did I say it right? All right. Also joining us via Skype from New York, Columbia University lecturer Zarandrian Morris. All right, folks. First and foremost, with this task force, do you believe that Spelman will eventually make this decision to allow transgender students to enroll at their all-female college?
Okay, my concern at this point is for oversight and protecting the humanity of the students. There are going to be haters who are going to potentially try to stymie progression by pledging resistance due to their offended sensibilities, especially those with galvanizing of the Black church. There will also be discussion and topic amongst individuals on that advisory board about derailing of funding potentially from alumni who may decide that they don't want to give to the college. And those efforts may stymie the progression of this monumental decision by Spelman.
Professor, go right ahead.
I do believe that eventually Spelman College will admit trans students. Personally, as a Spelman alum and also someone who is trans identified, I actually was hesitant to have this conversation because my stance is one that may garner like dissension from both trans and Spelman communities. In my opinion, I think as we stand right now, Spelman is not ready for trans inclusivity, especially when it comes to the inclusion of Black trans women and women of color. I think Spelman has issues existing that need to be addressed before we overlay that with gender identity. I think that the decision of the college right now does not appear to be rooted in a desire to expand the college's definition of women. I think it is rooted in a political move. And when you root things like gender identity in political moves, that erases the humanity. And I don't think that this will result in, like London said, protection of trans women of color. I think that Spelman has existing women that are still crying out for needs to be met. And I also think that just as a whole, Blackness isn't ready, is still struggling with sexual identity. And I don't think that overlaying gender identity on top of those unresolved issues is the move right now.
Well, if both of you are talking about how they're not ready then, well then how then say that they're gonna likely make the move? Because if they're not ready to do it, I mean, you do have to get your university, get your alumni, get everyone to that particular point because yes, what happens if there is a huge backlash? What happens if folks then begin to say, no, we're not going to fund? Now you're putting a university in peril. So what is required to get the university to that point? And give me a time frame. Do you think it's 2, 3, 5, 6, 7 years?
I think primacy and recency is really important. I think that you're absolutely correct. You have to get people ready, but I don't know if the response to that is accept trans folk and then people get ready as that happens. That is detrimental to the trans people that will be enrolled in the institution. I think that we, like I said before, I don't think Blackness as a whole is ready. That does not mean that I am against eventually including trans folk in the institution, but I can't necessarily put a time frame on that because I don't know what that means.
London?
I think that as a whole, like, you know, I don't know.
I refuse to believe that we are not prepared. During my matriculation at Morehouse College, there was this resonating sentiment on the campus that we wanted to become a global institution. And I think that at these bastions of knowledge, there's always been a foreground for social movement at these bastions of knowledge, especially when it came to civil rights. So I believe that we are prepared to admit students that are trans. However, I do believe there needs to be protocols put into place to make sure that we guarantee safe spaces for trans individuals who are admitted into the institution. But also there needs to be a larger conversation amongst the AUC consortium that would also protect students who are in the campus in this system as a whole.
We're going to our panel here. I've talked with some graduates. I mean, this has been a heated conversation. And even among Spelman graduates who are LGBT supporters. And so I wouldn't be surprised that even with this task force, you're going to have those feelings come out.
Right. Yeah. I think right now we're in a very pivotal moment when it comes to this issue about talking about trans inclusivity in Black spaces. I think not to go against what is clearly coming from my trans brothers and sisters on this issue, but I think we're in a place where, A, it's time to change. People are dying in the streets. We had our 19th trans woman killed just this year, Raylan, who is in Columbus, Ohio, my hometown. And Spelman College, if Spelman, and also as a graduate of a women's college, I believe these spaces can be safe spaces with the students leading, with the administration leading to get us to that space. I think also there are probably trans folks who are already in attendance at this school. We're having a lot of conversations about bathrooms. You've probably already shared a bathroom with a trans person. So I think Spelman is moving in the right direction. I will also yield, urge them to work with trans students, graduates, and otherwise to also make sure that they're safe spaces. And just one last point, going back to that, this kind of inclusivity can somehow deteriorate the school or hurt funding. That's the point. We need to be pushing in these directions. And I don't think it's going to, the inclusion of a group that is already there is going to hurt them.
Go ahead. You know, I do. Well, first and foremost, I don't think universities are should be safe spaces. They're, you know, supposed to be think tanks for debate and discussion.
How do you have a safe place to think without it being safe?
But I do think that Spelman is doing the right thing with this task force. I think with a decision like this, that you know it's going to be heated and controversial, you absolutely have to look at all sides. And I'm really interested to see what the task force comes up with.
I don't think that you should be denying anyone an education if they want to attend Spelman. I think they should be able to attend Spelman. I would have loved to attend Spelman.
But is it all women's college? Just like a woman couldn't go to Morehouse.
Yeah, right. Interject.
Well, women. Let's be clear that trans women are women.
Exactly.
Spelman is not a female college.
I'm speaking to Douglas's point. One second, Douglas, go ahead.
Yeah, well, and I, like I said, I don't think you should deny anyone an education. I think at some point you will hit a wall where maybe you want to take a pause there when it comes to sports, women's sports. I went and researched it when I saw this on the on the thing that you sent me last night, and I looked up Renee Richards, who was a tennis player, LGBT trans tennis player back in the 70s, and she came out and said, you know, you should not allow trans women to play women's sports, because if I had this operation, I had an advantage. He said, I had a competitive advantage when I was playing tennis, and had I had this operation directly 2 years before I entered the tennis world, there would have been no woman in the world that could beat me.
Go ahead.
One of the big issues that...
Professor, hold on 1 second. Go ahead.
One of the big issues that's being raised is by some feminists, and also you see institutions like Mount Holyoke who have come into light and have stated that women in the reduction of their bodily functions, that actually helps to oppress women, and that we must acknowledge that gender identity is not reducible to the body. I believe that gender is not what's between the legs, but what's between the ears and the heart. And oftentimes we tend to forget that when we're looking at this argument that gender identity is mutually exclusive than sex.
Professor, go ahead.
I think that, first of all, Spelman recently replaced its sports program with the health and wellness program, so we don't even have sports teams anymore. And I do agree 100% with what London is saying, is that gender and sex are two very different things. So when you have people that immediately conflate the two, which is still part of my argument that that is the problem, that we have yet to even understand that those two things are very different. And so when I hear people say things, make these improper conflations, it bothers me, because these are also people that are, like we said, possibly reducing funding. I mean, all Spelmanites are not created equal. Some of us have a deep understanding of gender and some of us don't. And some of us are connecting our funding dollars and some of us aren't. I think that it's very, very important that we get on the ball with how we're having these conversations about trans inclusivity and what that looks like in communities of color. Because you're absolutely correct. Trans women of color are being murdered at egregious rates. Mm-hmm. So I definitely wanted to raise that part, is that you don't even have to worry about the sports thing.
All right.
But I do think that that's interesting.
Well, we'll certainly see what happens next at Spelman College. Folks, thanks so much. I certainly appreciate it. Thank you very much. And when we come back, we'll talk about the 1936 Olympics. There were more than black athletes participating than just Jesse Owens. A new movie breaks it all down for us. Next on News 1 Now TV.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
$4.1 million, that's what New York City has agreed to pay the family of Akai Gurley, the unarmed black man shot and killed by a New York City police officer who was on patrol walking in a stairwell in a Brooklyn housing project 2 years ago. Peter Leong was convicted in that shooting of involuntary manslaughter, but he was sentenced to house arrest and community service. A lot of people are still stunned by that. So again, $4.1 million being paid to the family of Akai Gurley. Also, folks, let's talk about another story that we've been covering. That is what's taking place in Milwaukee. Okay, actually, I'm going to Chicago. Chicago Inspector General is trying to clean house and wants to at least 10 officers involved in the shooting death of Laquan McDonald fired or disciplined. Chicago Sun-Times reports the deputy chief who signed off on the McDonald police report was one of the first people on police superintendent Eddie Johnson's list to go. He wrote the report clearing officer Jason Van Dyke of any wrongdoing, but that deputy chief retired last Friday before he could be fired, keeping his pension. The video shows Officer Van Dyke shooting McDonald at least 16 times, even though he was running away. Van Dyke is now charged with murder. In July, a judge announced a special prosecutor would investigate the officers who had a different account from the dash cam footage. So we'll see if those officers are going to be fired. An update, folks, out of Milwaukee. That is, an 18-year-old shot in the neck during the Milwaukee protest is expected to fully recover. Police say the unidentified victim was shot late Sunday while protesting the shooting of an armed black man a day earlier. Police did not say who shot the man, but they are reportedly looking for suspects. Meanwhile, officers are enforcing a 10 p.m. curfew for all teenagers in hopes of stopping the fires and looting of local businesses. So, folks, we'll keep watching what takes place there in Milwaukee. Of course, the Olympics taking place right now. A lot of folks paying attention. But you see what happened in 1936, Jesse Owens, of course, winning 4 gold medals in Berlin. But there were other black athletes who performed there. A new film called Olympic Pride, American Prejudice, has been done talking about that particular film. We're joined right now by the director and the writer of that film. And so we're certainly glad to have her via Skype. Joining us right now. So let's talk about this film. It's an amazing film that you're laying out here. And that is because most people only focus on Jesse Owens. Your focus was to say the other black athletes.
Absolutely. In 1936, we're at a very pivotal point in our country. So you have 18 athletes who braved Jim Crow and braved Aryan supremacy to actually lay down the groundwork for the integration of sports as we know it. And our team thought it critically important to tell the full story, the holistic story, that there was more than one black person who was a part of this movement. There were 18, and that included two women, Tidy Pickett and Louise Stokes.
Deborah, I got to go to a break real quick, so I want to come back to you. So Deborah Riley Draper, hold tight 1 second. Let me get this break in. I'll be right back on News 1 on TV 1.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
The doc is Olympic Pride, American Prejudice by Deborah Riley Draper, narrated by Blair Underwood. And so Deborah joins us from Martha's Vineyard. So Deborah, these 17 remarkable athletes, again, Ralph Metcalf later runs for U.S. Congress, and so many others. What made their story so interesting for you?
The fact that their stories actually faded into obscurity and they did something so seminal and so important was really a seminal moment for us to understand our own history and our own contributions to sports and the struggle for equality. When you look at the list of people who are part of this 17 that disappeared, you're talking about Archie Williams, who became a Tuskegee Airman. You're talking about Dr. James LaValle, who a building at UCLA is even named for. So before they even set foot on the track in Berlin, they had already made history. They're the first African Americans ever to face both Jim Crow and Adolf Hitler to compete in sports. But they're also the ones that broke these lines of integration and the gentleman's agreement in college sports early on, because they're attending schools like University of Chicago, Berkeley, UCLA, Marquette, Ohio State. So what they were able to do in the 30s allowed athletes, Carl Lewis, Dr. Tommy Smith, and so on, to be able to do what they did years later.
Your film is being shown in limited release. So you're what? What cities are you in right now?
We just came out of New York and L.A. We're headed into Atlanta, Denver, and Chicago. You can also catch this on Comcast Xfinity On Demand. It's on Amazon pre-order. So the more support we have for this film, the more distribution options we'll have. But people can see it right now on Xfinity On Demand. And definitely pre-order for the holidays.
Well, it is certainly a remarkable story that details a part of American history that we often ignore. And so, Deborah, we appreciate it. We're going to go to actually the break playing a clip from it. So, again, as she said, you can certainly pre-order it in Atlanta, Chicago. Definitely want to watch it. Deborah, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Back on News 1 Now on TV 1 in just a moment.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
Birthday shout-out time. Actress Angela Bassett turns 58. Actor Reginald Vale Johnson, known for playing the father of Family Matters, turns 64. Y'all, I'm still trying to figure out that highway.
Highway to Africa, baby.
I'm easy transportation.
So we got the wall from Mexico and the highway to Africa. There we go.
And the island that tips over.
Yeah. With Hank Johnson. Part any more scenes.
No more scenes.
I would like Donald Trump to build me a walkway.
All right, y'all. Wild Night Wednesday's tomorrow. I thought it was today. Holla.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.